Service Project, a collection of public service origin stories. I'm Kate Dallaire, and I'm connecting with current and former public servants, one human and one story at a time. We're thinking through why we chose careers in service and what we've learned along the way. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Wes Rist. Wes is an atrocity prevention professional with nearly 20 years of experience in international human rights law, transitional justice, and international criminal justice. He currently serves as the Director of Government Affairs at the USC Shoah Foundation. He previously served as an atrocity prevention officer in the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations at the Department of State, and as the Deputy Executive Director and Director of Education and Research at the American Society of International Law. He's a member of the Prevention and Protection Working Group, which advised the U.S. government on genocide and atrocity prevention issues. He holds a JD and an LLM with distinction in international human rights law. Wes, I'm so happy that you're here today and thankful for you spending some time talking with me.
It's my pleasure, Caitlin.
So, as I always do, I want to begin by understanding where you grew up and what your childhood was like. What was really important to your family when you were a kid?
So I grew up in a very rural environment, fairly small. It was bordering on the edge of becoming suburban. And as I hit my teenage years, it became much more suburbanized. I remember when we first got rush hour traffic and that became a thing.
You're like, oh no.
Yeah. Well, my family was not a fan. Idea of having to wait in traffic was not an acceptable outcome. But it also meant we were fairly isolated. I grew up in between Philadelphia and Allentown, in Eastern PA. And, you know, there was very much a sense of, ooh, the big cities, like you gotta be careful when you go there, dangerous, lots of crime. You know, you're good in your community. You know who you need to know. I grew up very religiously conservative as well. So the church was the be all end all. My grandmother was kind of the matriarch of the church that I grew up in. Like, we literally were in the church every time the doors were open, and frankly, were there times when the doors weren't open, doing work, doing community outreach is what I would think of it as now. But we just thought of it as like helping out at the church, like painting, cleaning. Literally, I did custodial work at the church growing up. We re-racked pews hymnals into pews, after services, all that kind of stuff. So service was always a big part. And I grew up in a blue-collar family, as is quite common in those rural areas. So my dad was a school bus mechanic. My mom was a nurse. Both of those were important to their sense of identity in terms of giving to the community and working on behalf of someone greater or something greater than themselves. So I think all of that kind of was instilled very early, that, you know, working on behalf of others was a thing to be admired and even pursued.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I like that in that way. It doesn't sound like there's so much daylight or so much distance between public service careers in Washington or throughout the country and just like community service oriented jobs or even just volunteer capacity.
Yeah, I think so. I think the challenge, of course, is, you know, when you start talking about especially federal government service, the complexity of it, the nuance of it, you know, the fact that you are generating expertise in perhaps very esoteric fields makes it more challenging for that person who is doing the same, you know, objectively the same kind of work to equate them as the same thing.
Yeah. This is why I love to start with this question, because this tells us so much about what built you, like what made you someone who kind of just assumes that you should be using your life and your time to somehow make the world or your community, really on any scale, a better place.
Yeah.
Right. So I love getting right into that. And as I've said to others, when they're expressing curiosity about participating in the podcast, I'm like, really, this is just like an elaborate ruse for me to ask all these deep personal questions that are so awkward to ask people at a cocktail party.
Sure.
And why I don't thrive in that environment when I'm like, how's the weather? I really just want to be like, So how are you raised? What are you scared about? Like, but anyway, I'm so happy, you know, that I can do it like this now.
There
so
you
then
go.
You were raised in this rural community, and then you ended up pursuing a public service career. How did that happen?
Yeah, so it wasn't a straight line. Like, I knew I wanted to do something service oriented. I thought that was going to be in medicine because that was what I was exposed to. I was terrible at the mechanical side. Like, I worked in my dad's garage, but I was bad at it. He worked on his own for a very long time. So my brother and I were at the garage all the time. I can remember when he stopped calling me over to help because I was just so bad at it. And all of us were like, oh, thank goodness. Like,
everybody was relieved.
Yes, across the board. And my brother was phenomenal at that stuff. He's very good at the mechanical aptitude kind of things. Both he and my dad just understand that in a way I didn't. But my mom was a nurse and I loved the medical side. Like, that was fascinating. I love science. I still do. You know, it's a really great triggering kind of engagement for me. You know, sparks all that area of my brain that just gets really excited by that. I was the kid growing up who like read copies of Scientific American for fun. Like, you know, that was me. Lived in the library, so, and followed my mom around to the hospital any chance I got. So I went to school to be a doctor. And in undergrad, down in South Carolina, worked at a hospital, full-time to pay my way. I had to pay my way through school. Mm-hmm. You know, had no access to funding or resources for that. My family couldn't afford to pay it. So I was working full-time the night shift, after my first year at the local hospital, and eventually got onto the operating room floor, you know, that was fantastic as an orderly to help set up the rooms, prep patients, provide resources during the surgeries. And it was the night shift, so we saw only the most interesting of stuff, you know, car accidents, stabbings, shootings, all that kind of stuff.
It didn't freak you out?
No, I thrived on it. It was great. It was where I first learned that I was pretty good in a crisis setting.
Okay.
And that was due a lot to like the charge nurses training. Like, you know, I was comfortable with nurses because I'd grown up with one, understood how that worked, but was also learning, you know, how surgeons did stuff. But about the fifth or sixth time I saw someone have a negative outcome in surgery because like the residents had been awake for 3 days straight and that was how they taught, I was like, maybe a job where like the risk of a patient mortality is not part of the learning environment might mm-hmm. be better. And so I didn't know what I was going to do. Like all of a sudden, all of this training to be a doctor was no longer the primary goal. And I think there were some realities there of I was already looking for something a little bit more service oriented than the medical profession was becoming at that time. And I just didn't know what to do. And I had never met a lawyer before, had no knowledge of what lawyers did except for what was on Law and Order. I think looking back, like one time my parents had consulted a lawyer in regards to something that happened with our local township council, but we weren't ever introduced to her. I didn't know hers. And it was literally a one and done kind of thing. So it wasn't a part of my awareness. But I had a family friend who ended up going to law school, and I went up to visit her. Her younger sister was my best friend growing up. So we went up to visit her for something completely unrelated. And I kid you not, Kate, the plane landed so early that instead of going to her apartment where we were going to meet her and go do our sightseeing stuff, she was like, well, I'm not going to be home for a couple of hours. Do you want to come to the law school and hang out with me at the law school? And we did. And I sat in a constitutional law class at the back of the room.
Oh my gosh.
And was just like, I want this. I didn't know this was an option.
Yeah.
No one told me I could do this. There's this running thing of lawyers in law school where they call gunners. It's the people who always try and answer the questions first and are always. I was a gunner before I was a law student. Like I was sitting in the back of that class trying to raise my hand and answer the questions. And
they're like, who are you?
Yeah, literally like not on the roster at all. Just I'm like, this is great. And it just captured me. I was like, this is how I can use. I was on debate in high school. I was in student government, student legislature, not student government, in college. I was like, this is how I can use all of those different interests and policy and law and debate and argumentation in one place, and immediately saw the opportunity for public service there. I was anticipating I would go into some kind of local government, or like my initial focus was in the DA's office or something like that. And so that was my approach to law.
You know it when you see it. Sometimes you're not sure what you're meant to do in life, but then when you see it, it just hits.
Yeah, but it literally came like I was in my senior year. So I took a break between my end of my college career and law, starting law school, which is something I do highly recommend for any undergrads listening. Like, take some time off between undergrad and grad school or law school and go do something else first. It was really valuable.
But so can we just take a second to reflect on how funny it is that you left the medical field because of the risk of patient mortality, and you decided to go into work trying to prevent genocide? You're like, that'll be less stressful.
I didn't, it wasn't a direct line.
But we get there eventually, so.
You do,
all the threads.
Yeah, yep.
Well, okay,
I will
amazing.
Say the crisis management from the operating room has been invaluable throughout my career, like, without a doubt.
Okay,
yeah.
And so then you find yourself moving toward public service. And I understand then you did a study abroad experience?
Yeah, so because I worked full-time in undergrad, I did not have a chance to do study abroad, and I knew I wanted to. I ended up being a history major because I had you know, switched it around when I knew I didn't want to go to medical school afterwards, and was kind of literally just going to law school. They had just announced, the ABA had just announced that you could now get a full year's worth of credits from study abroad and have it count towards your JD. And I immediately went, that means I can like live overseas for a year, come back and graduate with everyone and just be overseas. I was what international student advisors hate. I was the guy who wanted to go live overseas, not because I wanted to do international law, but because I just was like, I want to live overseas for a year. This sounds great. Yeah. I never had gotten to. And I picked a bunch of universities to apply to. It had to be direct enroll. So I was applying to enroll, and I had specialized in the history of England. And so I was like, I'm going to go study in England. And basically it was my excuse to just travel England while I was doing classes.
Had you ever traveled overseas before that?
Once. I had gone to Honduras on a missions trip when I was growing up as a 14-year-old. Which was a very eye-opening experience and was definitely an important part of me thinking about this, because, you know, I had grown up in a, you know, relatively low income. And then, you know, by the time I was a teenager, low middle class family. But I did not ever wonder about, you know, food security or anything like that. Going to the, you know, indigent communities of San Pedro Sula in Honduras was an eye-opening experience for a 14-year-old who had never been outside of, you know, Eastern PA rural communities, like, except for family vacations.
I had a similar experience because I also grew up in a family that was, I would say, lower middle class. Like, we had everything that we needed, but my parents were definitely paycheck to paycheck, like just scraping by. Yeah. And compared to other people in my community, I always felt like we had less, like we were barely making it. But then I traveled when I was 19 to volunteer in Peru with this really cool volunteer program that I don't think even exists anymore. And I saw like true poverty, and that changed my life.
Yeah, there was definitely some reverse culture shock when I came back about like food waste and things like that. But, you know, that was my first trip, but I hadn't gone again since then. And so now I'm 23. So it's been almost a decade since I've been overseas. And I'm just like, I'm going. This is my last chance. I didn't think I was going to do anything related to international. So like, you know, this is where I get my chance to go. Student loans will pay for it. And so I selected a university in the UK that had a really great faculty that was teaching a criminal justice program, because I wanted to go into criminal justice. Okay. And I got over there, and in the UK, law school starts like 6 weeks later than it does in the US. So I was really excited because my loans came in on time, but I had 6 weeks to basically, and the you know, the housing was open. So I went and moved into the apartment, and I had like a month on my own just to like explore England. It was fantastic. I took trains everywhere. I did a ton of history research, well, research. I went and saw historical places that I had studied. It was great. But literally a week before classes started, so this is the very end of September, the criminal justice program, which had, I want to say it was like 31 students registered for it or something, and 28 of them were Pakistani peacekeepers that the UN was
Oh,
paying to
wow.
send to the program.
Okay.
This is the mid 2000s, and all of a sudden they all get called up to go to Afghanistan. And the university was like, we are not running a program for three people. Like, you need to pick a different LLM is the degree, Masters of Letters of Law. They're like, you need to pick a different program. And my mind was blown because I was like, I can't go back to the States. Like, classes have been going for 6 weeks. I can't fold right back into class. What do I do? And I kid you not, Kate, I picked international human rights law. Because there were three classes that had crime in the title. And I thought maybe some DA down the line will like, one, I thought a DA would actually look at my course transcript. I don't know why I thought that for a hiring decision. And two, I was like, oh, and they'll be fooled because it says international criminal law and I think I know something about criminal law, which no, of course not. But I immediately fell in with this group of, I want to say like 25, 27, I forget exactly how many of us, students who all of them were intentionally there to study human rights law. That's what they were. And I was the only American. There were, I think, two other Brits. And then the rest of the class was from around the world and literally global in nature. A bunch of Commonwealth country people, of course. Nigeria, Kenya. Some from Singapore. There was some folks from Germany, I think were the only other Europeans. Oh no, there was someone from the Netherlands, I believe, as well. Some South Africans, both black and white, which was very interesting. And then folks from, across the spectrum of countries, including some from South America, which was astonishing. And they kind of were like, I was very strident. I was kind of an asshole. Very convinced I knew what the right answers were to things without having any, because I was smart, I was bright, I had done a ton of reading and research and was more up on things than average. But I was also very much Americanized in terms of in that mid 2000s range of the conflict starting. I thought we're doing the right thing. I know exactly what this is. I knew nothing about international law, but was convinced that I knew that what we were doing was in compliance with international law. Like that confidence of the uninformed. And they were incredibly engaging with me and were kind of like, oh no, you have a lot to learn. Like at one point, they took me out grocery shopping and I went to buy something and they were like, oh, we don't buy Nestle products, Wes. And I was like, why don't we buy Nestle products? And they're like, don't you know what Nestle does? And I was like, no, they're like, we boycott Nestle. I was like, what's a boycott? And they're like, oh, okay. So we have a lot to teach you. And, they did. And frankly, I learned a ton from my professors who were experts in their field of human rights. My collective security professor was one of the negotiators for the UN on the South Sudan peace treaty. My
Oh, wow.
Human rights professor was just coming back from 2 years advising the African Union on the Convention on the Rights of the Child. My refugee law professor was writing the white paper for the British government on their effort to redo their refugee laws. They were an amazing faculty. I learned more from my classmates who just had different experiences, different lived realities of the world, who, grew up in the shadow of American power and just changed my understanding. It wasn't a radical shift, it was just I
It's a
learned to
different
question
vantage point.
things. Yeah, I learned to ask questions about what I thought I knew or what I thought the right assumptions were. And it wasn't a, oh, immediately I went from these opinions to these opinions. It was, I don't know as much as I think I know, and I need to be open to asking some questions about these things because I absolutely put my foot in it a few times, and clearly I need more knowledge.
This is something that I just talked about on a recording a couple of weeks ago, and so it'll air before yours as well, with Judd Devermont, who is known as an Africa expert, but says he now is so uncomfortable with the title of expert because the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. I think it's really cool that you're showing us also that the people you surround yourself with are like everything to your growth and development, because I feel like we learn so much more from our peers, I think, than through like traditional instructive relationships in our lives.
Well, and I think frequently we are more open to having our opinions challenged by our peers than by authority figures. There's something different of having a professor or a boss tell you you're wrong.
Yeah.
To having the guy you go and have drinks with or go to board game nights with or just hang out in the library until 3 a.m. with doing assignments, be like, yeah, but that's not what I know. And you're both in this together. That changes things.
Yeah.
Immensely.
And so then having kind of gained this different perspective, how did you end up joining the State Department?
Yeah, so that also was not a straight line, because it was over it was over a decade. In fact, it was over 12 years, 13 years before I ended up there. So I went back to law school, immediately dove into international law. I was like, this is what I want to do. Like, I knew I wanted to help communities, but now I was like, international human rights law and international criminal law specifically is a thing that exists. I didn't know there were tribunals. I had heard of the Rwanda genocide, of course, and of the Bosnian or of the former Yugoslavian issues, but I didn't know. And then I came back and was like, okay, I'm going to take classes on this. Dove into, there was a war crimes class that was being taught. I actually took that with a individual who I'm not going to name, but was a survivor of the bombing, the NATO bombing of Kosovo, who told the story of like hiding under the table with her family and saying, we were actually happy because it meant that someone was paying attention to what was happening to us and choosing to do something about it. And that was very, you know, moving experience. And so eventually moved to DC to pursue another job at the American Society of International Law. That was a great experience, tons of exposure, broad communities. I was training lawyers from judges from the ICJ down to local lawyers who had never heard of international law. But I also got involved with what you mentioned in the bio, the PPWG, the Prevention and Protection Working Group, where we were looking to actually, instead of being reactive to war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide and punishing perpetrators after the fact, I became very fascinated by the idea that we could stop these things from happening. There is without a doubt, and this is an incredible outcome of the body of law and research and knowledge that comes out of Holocaust studies and genocide studies, we know when an atrocity is coming. There has never been a recorded atrocity where we have sufficient data that we can't look back and say, oh, the warning signs were there. So these are not surprises. When people talk about being surprised that something happened, that's a political narrative to avoid blame, not a reflection of reality. And so I started working on this idea that we could prevent these issues before they got started. And in that context, got very involved with advising the U.S. government. And so slowly over time, built up a practice of engagement with the U.S. government on specific issues, you know, worked with multiple different organizations. ASIL was very supportive to allow me to do that on my own time, even if that meant during the day. So as long as I was getting the work done, they were like, oh, if you have to go at noon to do a briefing, that's fine. Started off being private briefings and the like. And then eventually, once the Elie Wiesel Genocide and Atrocity Prevention Act got passed, this is the act that codifies atrocity prevention efforts within the U.S. government. One of the outcomes of that was now the executive branch had to file a report with Congress each year on what it was doing.
Right.
And the civil society community very quickly realized that this was an opportunity to provide feedback on what the U.S. government was doing in a very formal way, because this is a congressional report. And I very, very vividly remember the moment where we were sitting in this civil society meeting, talking amongst ourselves, being like, we should really prepare a response to their report. who wants to do this? And everyone was just kind of like sitting there because it was going into the summer break and we all knew that this would be a ton of work.
Yeah.
And I remember having this thought of like, boy, if I put my hand up and say I will do this, my next three weekends are gone. Like, that's all I'm going to be doing for the next three weekends. But I bet this would be a great way to like really gain some expertise and you know, build some connections and so on. So I put my hand up and said, okay, I'll take a run at it. I was wildly optimistic. It was like my next seven weekends were gone.
Right.
And I also, because I'm a lawyer by training, and you know the joke stands if we get paid by the word, I produced a much longer report than I think they thought they were going to get. Like, I reached out to a bunch of civil society colleagues and was like, what do you think about this part of the report that they filed, et cetera? And we actually published like a 22-page assessment of the government's report. And then some really great, well-connected colleagues said, well, we should actually like do something with this. So instead of just putting it up on the website,
yeah,
we set up briefings to the State Department. We set up briefings to the National Security Council. We set up briefings to Congress and congressional offices. And all of a sudden now I was actually sitting at the table with the State Department colleagues, with the Justice Department, Defense Department colleagues, USAID, telling them what we thought of their report. And it wasn't, oh, we think this is terrible. It was like, here are the things we loved. Here are the things you did great. Here are the things that we think can be improved upon. And here's the stuff that we're not seeing that we really want to see. And I spent 4 years doing that. I became the person who wrote that, who gave the briefings criticizing the U.S. government on their atrocity prevention response. Mm-hmm. And after the fourth time, the Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations reached out and said, we're expanding our team. And we want to know if you want to take all that critique that you've been doing over the last several years and bring it to work on behalf of this portfolio inside of the government. And I literally jumped at the chance.
Yeah.
To finally take that and move and step into that more policy oriented, obviously more restricted role, because you're now working on behalf of the U.S. government.
Yeah.
You don't get to say what you think on everything. But also found it incredibly rewarding to be able to take that expertise and bring it to the service of the broader American population and the community of the world on these important issues.
And then during that time, and I'm sure as a result of your efforts and the efforts of so many others, then the State Department actually started doing some amazing training on atrocity prevention. And I was lucky enough to go to one of those trainings.
Oh, really?
And that is how I learned about atrocity prevention. I was working on peacekeeping operations. Okay. And so I went there mainly to take the course, but then I ended up giving like a mini briefing during the course on how peacekeeping operations actually contribute to atrocity prevention.
Brilliant.
So it was an amazing experience, and it was such a cool training because it's one that they offer all over the world, so that people from different embassies, as well as people from Washington, can join and have conversations together about like how they're seeing these things implemented at post or in a conversation with the interagency or other areas. So excellent training and one of the many good things to come out of all your work.
Yeah. One of my, you know, good friends and wonderful colleagues runs that program out of DRL.
Yeah.
And I've been privileged to teach that both at the FSI facility and in one of the international trainings. And you know, the number of people who come, we joke about the A word in the State Department, you know, people hear atrocities and they're like, oh, please, no, don't. I had one desk officer, you know, who I knew, saw me walk into the office and was, oh, no, the angel of death is coming.
It's like, great. Yeah, but it's atrocity prevention. It's actually a very optimistic area of work to think like there are these horrible things happening.
Yes.
And there are things that we can do about it. Now, the challenge also ends up being there are, even at this moment, multiple atrocities ongoing.
Yes.
And so there's the challenge. And that's also the role of civil society to keep these issues on the government's mind and also publicly to continue to talk about them. People, there are several people in my network who are so vocal about what's happening in Sudan right now and continue to keep it on people's radar. And that work is so important and so thankless and sometimes probably feels really discouraging. So I'm glad that there are people out there who understand atrocity prevention and are doing that. What do you want people to understand about human rights and atrocity prevention work if they just have like no familiarity with what these words really mean day to day?
Yeah, sure. I think I'll let others speak to the broader human rights questions because, as I said, you know, I've specialized in such a way that I don't want to step outside my lane.
Yeah.
But in the atrocity prevention community, I think it's worth knowing when we say the words atrocity prevention, we're actually talking about three distinct phases. We're talking about prevention, like the actual upstream work of trying to stop these things before they happen. We're talking about response. The Sudan Civil War kicked off literally 4 weeks after I joined the State Department. I spent my entire time at the State Department working on Sudan, sometimes very long hours. I was privileged enough to have worked with Sudanese civil society actors before I joined State, so I had an incredible community of people that I could connect with. And frankly, one of the things I'm proudest of my civil service is being able to bring those voices into rooms where they may not have otherwise had access, because I knew them and was able to get them in front of people who could hear exactly what was taking place, especially at the start of the conflict when information was so difficult to come by. So there's the response to ongoing crises. One of the real challenges, people think, oh no, there's atrocities happening in Sudan. And are, yes, there are, but there's still prevention work to be done there because it could be worse. Like, there are things that we can do to try and limit how bad those atrocities are in the moment. The toolbox is much smaller when you're in a crisis moment.
Yeah.
Like, we just don't have as many things we can do. And obviously with USAID gone, you know, that's even further reduced. But there are things that we work towards, even in the middle of an ongoing crisis, to try and prevent atrocities. And then there is the third phase, which is the recovery phase, which includes things like transitional justice, remembrance, memorialization, efforts to try and seek out accountability, whether that be like Western-style criminal law approaches or more community-based engagement.
Reconciliation.
Yes. Yeah. And some of those things, like one of the really difficult things about this field is there is a cycle of impunity and a cycle of violence that can come back around. And if you don't address the societal harms that occur when atrocities happen, you are just setting yourself up for the number one indicator of a potential mass atrocity is that a previous atrocity has not been addressed by that society.
That was the one thing that stuck out in my mind. Like, if I only remembered one thing from the whole course, it was that's the greatest predictor of a future atrocity is a past atrocity. And it makes sense.
That has not been addressed.
Right.
That has not been resolved, without a doubt. And so it is challenging because it's where we see really difficult things like survivor communities becoming perpetrators because they're so afraid of becoming victimized again, that they
hurt people.
Like, on a societal scale, hurt people. So trying to figure out how to embrace the recovery side of things, also really critical. All of those are our work. So prevention, response, and recovery. In terms of what I wish people would know is that this work happens best behind the scenes without any fanfare. We used to joke that I don't care if anyone says the words atrocity prevention in doing the things that we come up with that might help reduce risks and build resiliencies.
Yeah.
The other two really important facts, these are not opinions. This is proven, demonstrable fact. Every single society on the face of the planet is capable of committing atrocities. There is no such thing as a society that will never commit atrocities. Human beings are just wired to other people and to create, separation and to say us versus them. And when you have communities that create us versus them dynamics, you create the risk of mass atrocities. So every one of us needs to be vigilant about that. And every country on the face of the planet has atrocity risks right now. There are risks of atrocities occurring everywhere. Many countries have very strong institutions, practices, communities, faiths, social constructs that prevent those risk factors from tipping over into atrocities. So just because there are risks doesn't mean that it will happen, because there are resiliencies as well.
Right.
And so we want those resiliencies to be strong. But there does seem to be a concerted effort across multiple different styles of governance and regions of the world to break down many of the things that contribute to those resiliencies, which puts us at greater risk. And so I worry, as someone who spent more than 15 years working in this field now, I worry about how much those resiliencies are being shattered, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. And one of the unintended consequences of that is that it actually increases the risk of atrocities occurring.
Yeah. And so then, really, it's the dehumanization. Like, that would be the, like, the smallest sort of unit of measurement. And so everything that builds humanity and connection is a resiliency, right?
We have a term for this in the field, like a very, you know, jargony kind of approach, which is social cohesion. So the things that you do to make a community feel like it is integrated and part of a bigger whole is social cohesion. And that can be, you know, education programs that say it doesn't matter where you live in the country, if there's a north-south or an urban-rural or a pastoral versus agricultural kind of divide, you know, recognizing that those communities, even though they don't look, sound, believe, act, eat, whatever, like us, are still part of us, is building resiliencies. And things that tear that social cohesion apart, like you said, the smallest unit of this is othering or dehumanization. Those are creating risks and building risks.
And so then it's impossible to ignore how applicable this is to our own context, and the fact that, you know, there's a strong kind of current right now of othering. And I think this is not new. This has happened throughout American history, throughout, as you've pointed out, probably every country's history at some point, but being aware of it. And I think this is why this is kind of the maybe unseen or underappreciated benefit that public servants offer, is their experience of observing and studying things in so many different contexts and being able to understand in a holistic way what works well, what are warning signs and red flags, and to understand that they do not, it doesn't matter what country you're looking at, what context you're looking at. We're all human beings and we all have these certain behaviors. And capacity for great love and good and decency as well. And so there's a lot to work with there.
We have seen, you know, in just about every culture that I've ever seen around the world, this capacity to step beyond the instinct to lean into the fear between different groups, to say, you know, they're out to get us, I will be less if they get more, to view things as a zero-sum game. And we have seen in just about every culture that I have ever engaged with on broader human rights issues and on atrocity issues, people who are willing to step up and say, no, that's not the case. We are more together. We are stronger together. We can step beyond this evolutionary biology trait of, you know, we must create an us versus a them to create safety, and instead say we are a global species that works together.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this, because we're looking at the individual as like the smallest unit, I think that a lot of this brings me back to the things I've learned about parenting too, because I have three boys, and you know, conflict between siblings is unavoidable. But through negotiating settlements between my kids, I've observed also kind of what are the conditions that allow the greatest amount of harmony. And I always am thinking about like, how do we replicate those conditions on bigger scales? But I want to give you the opportunity to answer a question that I think you are so well equipped to answer for us, and that maybe a lot of people are wondering at this moment. If it's not clear already, how does atrocity prevention work in other countries around the world benefit U.S. national security? Why does it matter? And not to say that I think that people that are listening are heartless and don't care if other people are dying around the world. It's that maybe people are like, well, I'm struggling to pay my bills, yeah, or I'm having a hard time keeping my kids in school or paying for daycare or whatever. How does this matter?
Yeah. And it's a very fair question because, you know, communities are struggling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot to be examined in terms of how we are addressing the income inequality gap and the access to opportunities gap in America. There's a growing rural versus urban divide in America. There's growing food insecurity in frankly frightening levels in America. I remember being a teenager in early 20s and thinking, oh, we just turn off all foreign assistance and we focus on the domestic things and fix things domestically and then we'll be better and then we can work. And the problem is we live in a different world than we did before roughly the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And the shorthand term for this is globalization. But the reality is we live in a world that is interconnected in ways that are frankly beyond the ability of the human brain to understand.
And we cannot put the genie back in the bottle.
No, you can't just revert back to it. There's not enough resources that we actually need in any single country, even one as large and with as diverse of a natural resource footprint as America, to just be internally self-sufficient. That's not a thing that's going to happen because of our reliance on technology, because of our reliance on global trade, because of our reliance of integrated incomes and economic systems in the world. The implications of that are that places in the world that you may never have heard of, that you could not find on a map and that most people can't, could have a huge impact on your day-to-day life if things suddenly go very bad there.
Yeah.
And this can be everything from rare earth minerals and metals that are really difficult to come by and only exist in a very few places on the world, but are in every smart device on the planet. Folks may have heard of conflict minerals. This idea of, it used to be the 3T, tin, tungsten, and titanium. I think it's a different collection of minerals now that come from some of the most conflict-prone areas in the world. And when those conflicts break out, those minerals become exceptionally difficult to get out. There are documented cases of, militia groups targeting mines and communities that extract these resources and basically turning them into indentured forced labor because they can then sell those minerals on for a profit to fund their conflict. Mm-hmm. And if we can find ways to prevent that from breaking out into armed conflict before it happens, not only do we save those people who are now no longer at risk, immediate risk of becoming this kind of forced labor enslaved population, but also we prevent the shock to the market of this mineral becomes insanely more expensive and supply chains become complicated. And then there's also the potential, because we've all lived through a global pandemic, of what happens when disease spreads. And armed conflict is one of those situations in which disease can spread like wildfire.
Of course.
And when you have situations of armed conflict, you see that kind of vector for disease because people scatter and they go different places. Mm-hmm. And it's not nice and neat and organized. They are just fleeing for their lives. And they're crossing international borders. They're engaging with camps. Refugee camps are not some kind of resort that people go to and take money off of the broader international community. They are some of the most difficult places. The most humbling experience I have ever had in my professional career is being in a refugee camp, thinking I knew what that was like, and then seeing the reality and just being heartbroken of what people are being forced to endure. And that's after they have fled for their lives.
Right.
And that creates migration pressures. That creates challenges to immigration and to conduct. It also creates the opportunities for terrorist entities to recruit and to build new bases. of support.
Right. And 9/11 was the perfect example of the fact that these things come back around somehow. And,
you know, international crime thrives in these kinds of places. The drug trafficking, human trafficking, forced indentured servitude, all of those kinds of things thrive in these situations.
Yeah.
And so for the average American, are they going to feel the direct impact on their life day in, day out? No. Are they going to notice the effects and not realize where the cause is coming from? Absolutely yes. And that's one of the challenges of the foreign policy field, is that cause is often very far removed from effect.
And telling the story is very difficult, because a lot of times the story is about the prevention of a crisis or a catastrophe that never comes to pass. And so you don't know what you've avoided.
I can't prove direct causation for the places where we've done work and hopefully made a difference, because it could have been any number of different things. And frankly, I don't need to substantively prove it in terms of understanding the value. It is difficult to go to Congress year after year as an administration and say, you should fund this and you should fund it more, and to convince my State Department colleagues that we should do this because it's difficult work and you don't get credit for it. And it's really challenging. And it takes 6 to 8 years in advance. And the State Department, like all ministries of foreign affairs, is really terrible about looking past the horizon, not responding to the immediate crisis.
And that's only going to be more challenging now, based on like the fact that so much expertise is leaving and institutional memory. But on a much lighter note, because we're going to be wrapping up and I really like to end on a positive note.
Good.
Can you tell me about a moment when you really feel like your work or your advice contributed to a positive change?
Yeah, so it is challenging because many of the things I work on I can't talk about publicly, but I can give an example of something that anecdotally we've heard. So after Russia invaded Ukraine, I was still in civil society at the time, and I was called in with a couple of other experts on atrocity prevention to brief the National Security Council, and was asked, hey, you know, we know atrocity going on in Ukraine. And in a weird way, like, we didn't have to prove it because Russian soldiers were like filming things on their personal cameras and sending it around on Telegram. And it was insane. So like, what can we do on prevention? And this is where I kind of, I think for the first time, said, look, you're asking for what tools are in the toolbox, and it's in the middle of an ongoing crisis. So there's like only three tools in the toolbox, and one of them is a hammer, and no one likes the hammer. So we are limited in what we can do to actually prevent these atrocities in the moment of crisis. It's why prevention work is so important.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, what you need is to be calling it out. Like, be overt. You know that people are committing mass atrocities. You have evidence of that. Call them out. I want someone from the podium of the State Department spokesperson to be saying, this is unacceptable. We are watching. You will be held accountable. And you know, we kind of made that pitch. And I am absolutely sure I am not the only person who was making that pitch. Other people were saying, you need to be doing this. But I am really proud of the fact that 2 days later, Ned Price, who was spokesperson for the State Department at the time, got up at the podium and said, I just want to say something, you know, during a briefing. He said, I just want to add one thing. The U.S. government is watching. The world is watching. We are seeing these atrocities be committed. There will be accountability. You will have to answer for the acts that you are committing.
Because fundamentally, this work is about the truth. It's about like the truth informing the course of action. It's also about the truth being the essential ingredient to healing. To like, that's why we have truth and reconciliation and restorative justice and all of these things that are kind of the elements for breaking that cycle and preventing a future atrocity.
It's also why I'm so worried about, you know, the rise in mis and disinformation as well.
Exactly. You read my mind. Yeah, because the truth is undeniably like the key ingredient for peace and justice. So it has been amazing talking with you today, Wes. And I think for anybody who's listening, I'm sure that you have piqued their curiosity and maybe inspired some other people to take a completely indirect route to the kind of advocacy and legal work that you've done. And I just really want to take a moment to thank you, not only for talking with me today, but for your service.
Thank you. It's been a privilege. I greatly enjoyed it. And I very much hope I get to return to public service at some point in the future. I think there's this element of once you've gotten a taste of it, you're kind of like, yeah, that's a life well lived, contributing to the general well-being of not just the American people, but of our global community.
Well, I hope you do too. Thank you, Wes.
Thanks, Kate.